Welcome.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. It's November 29th, 2023. My name is Michael Anthony Norton. And we're talking about the climate today. COP28 has kicked off in the United Arab Emirates. We're going to be talking in three special episodes the next couple of weeks, to focus as an auxiliary communications point. I think that is the point of conferences that the G20 has with the United Nations delegates. And we're going to learn about that process during these podcasts. And today's show will focus on the first of three benchmarks I would hope could be reached by such a high level, a higher echelon as the G20 COP28 conference attendees. And that is the first of three benchmarks being the global temperature. We all know ordinarily the human body temperature as a standard temperature that is not disputable. It's in common practice in nutrition, health, fitness, and medical disciplines, as we know from a very young and early age in our lives. The global temperature is a little different, and we're going to talk about that. It's not as set as one would think. And I think that's one of the reasons they have these conferences, to try and reach agreements and standards related to such. Now, the World Trade Organization, the World Health Organization, and the World Meteorological Organization, all three, I think it's better not to underemphasize what setbacks all three of those organizations have faced in the past 20 years because of the events of September 11th, 2001. The World Trade Centers were lost, but the significant setbacks in organization and administration at the World Health Organization and the World Trade Organization and the World Meteorological Organization need not be so underemphasized, because every nation that participates in those programs have also endured incredible setbacks in terms of organizational management and structure and leadership, which carry on through to the local levels and the state levels within those sovereign nation collectives on planet Earth. Right here to people like me, podcasting on the web, or sending emails, or building websites, or whatever you do in your community. So the third benchmark of these three that might be met is kind of a, we'll talk about in the third podcast 2 weeks from today, about a memo of understanding or agreement to make a pledge to reach a standard related to the climate and these systems in practice today and in practice 20 years ago and even longer than that. But this morning we will learn about COP. What is COP? And then we'll get to more specific discussion about the global temperature. Now, I have a system, as you know, of magnetism I've been formalizing, just as we have systems of biology and chemistry and communication. And I would like to present the global temperature argument, contrary to the one that's published online later this hour, or later in these 2 hours, because I think it's a standard that can be reached and proven by all the participants in these various initiatives. But right now, what is COP? A critical moment in global transformative climate action. This is from the COP28 website. I have on blogtalkradio.com/struck-forth these programs titled COP28 or COPCON28. I think it used to be references COPCON as conference, COP conference 28, but right now it's just COP28. In the 3 decades since the Rio summit and the launch of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Conference of the Parties to the Convention, COP, Conference of the Parties to the Convention, COP, has convened member countries every year to determine ambition and responsibilities and identify and assess climate measures. Okay, so this must be, this is from the COP site, like I said, the COP28 site. This must be in coordination with the World Meteorological Organization, which I think had its headquarters built in Switzerland in 1993, which we'll also get to, which was 3 decades ago. The 21st session of the COP, COP21, led to the Paris Agreement, which mobilized global collective action to limit the global temperature increase to 1.5 Celsius above pre-industrial levels by 2100, and to act to adapt to the already existing effects of climate change. You can call in on the show too. I have invited many guests. None have responded. We may have as much an extraordinary innovation in despondency as we do in respondency 20 plus years after that horrible day on September 11, 2001. But that's not the topic of this show. You can call in at 563-999-3703. Spoke to a doctor recently about this, and I asked the doctor, and this is an Ivy Leaguer doctor, do you think it's possible that we could live in a world someday where the common cold is the only medical problem or whatever, without any disease and disorder other than the common cold? And he said, yes, I do believe that's possible. And I think that if we can land on a global temperature, an average global temperature that Mother Earth provides us every day, just like she does for our internal body temperature, that we know we're healthy, that's a good step forward in that direction of living in a world without disease and disorder. So I will continue reading from the COP28 website. COP28 President Designate G20 Ministerial Chennai Remarks. COP28 President Designate urges G20 nations to lead the way and demonstrate solidarity on climate action. There is still time for the G20 to show leadership, and I am calling on all of you to work with your leaders to drive global climate action in this critical decade. Right now, many of the indicators are going in the wrong direction. Temperature records continue to be broken, with this month officially recorded as the hottest in history. We are losing biodiversity. Agricultural land is being degraded, and food insecurity is increasing. And I think this is, while I printed this out yesterday from the website. I think this month he's referring to past month. I don't think it's this actual month. But I do know that I went for a walk this morning here in Bangor, Maine, and it is very cold. It's like in the 20s with a wind chill factor that makes it so nice that your nose doesn't even sniffle because you're pretty much frozen as you walk. But this is still, it's still very warm considerably from places like St. Petersburg. It's probably 10 degrees latitude more north than this towards the Arctic. If we are going to make progress on adaptation, we first have to define what success looks like in terms of stopping biodiversity loss, restoring agricultural land, preserving forests, protecting coastlines, ensuring no one goes hungry, and safeguarding lives and livelihoods everywhere. G20 nations should make transformation of food systems a top priority. That seems like, to me, that last punctuation point, G20 nations should make transformation of food systems a top priority. I don't know how that got on to the script for the climate conference, but they do, and they can explain why. But I don't think it's, and I say that because I don't think it's exceptionally important that I can have an orange or a piece of fruit, and it's all the way from Israel or Peru. I don't see how that's helping advance when it can be just as sustained here in my locality. But I guess there's an economy to it, isn't there? Your national adaptation, no, there's not. No, not when other things are considered. I think they've gone, in other words, my opinion is I think they've gone and emphasized too much a global transportation system of food resources. In a little bit of surplus. Your national adaptation plans and strategies should promote sustainable land use, leverage technologies to increase crop resilience, enhance nutrition, and reduce the climate impacts of farming. Right. Enhance nutrition is a big one. Doubling adaptation finance by 2025 is a critical first step, but we need to look at directing a solid proportion of all climate finance toward adaptation responses. Yet we must acknowledge that many vulnerable countries, in particular small island developing states and least developed countries, are already experiencing consequences of climate change that go beyond what people can adapt to. And COP28 is taking place starting today for the next 2 weeks in the United Arab Emirates. The UAE's proven track record on climate action. As the first country in the region to ratify the Paris Agreement, the first to commit to an economy-wide reduction in emissions, and the first to announce a net zero by 2050 strategic initiative, the UAE is committed to raising ambition in this critical decade for climate action. Our 2015 nationally determined contribution made us the first country in the region to commit to an economy-wide reduction in emissions by 2030. And we launched the National Net Zero by 2050 pathway in November 2022, which sets the framework, the time frame, and identifies the mechanisms to implement the UAE Net Zero by 2050 strategic initiative. The UAE was one of only 29 countries to submit a revised second NDC. That's a nationally determined contribution ahead of COP27. The enhanced target is expected to translate into an absolute emissions reduction of about 93.2 million metric tons of CO2. I haven't done my research because I don't know what CO2e is. I don't know if that's a typo or an electronic reference. I don't know. Is it a standard to another standard reference? Or is carbon dioxide E something other than carbon dioxide? Here we will hear about the leadership. Again, you can call in 563-999-3703. I know it's 10 a.m. in the morning here on the East Coast, United States, Canada, and Mexico, which means it's 8 p.m., I think, if I'm doing my in-mind conversion right from Moscow. Dr. Sultan Ahmed Al-Haber, President-Designate for COP28 UAE. And forgive me if I'm mispronouncing your name. Dr. Al-Jaber is the first CEO to ever serve as COP President and brings with him sound business acumen, a deep understanding of economics, and leverages his decades-long experience in the energy sector, encompassing both renewable and traditional energy. And that's another thing I wanted to say. Nobody talks about in general media satellite power these days, but that's something that's very real and practical and reasonable with regard to both fossil fuels and renewables and grid infrastructure and resiliency and reliance on those systems. I think satellite power will be a thing of tomorrow. During Dr. Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber's double tenure as Special Envoy for Climate Change, 2010 to 2016 and 2020 to present, Dr. Al-Jaber has played a seminal role in shaping the country's clean energy path, including as founding CEO and currently the chairman of Masdar Abu Dhabi's pioneering renewable energy initiative that has since become a leading global clean energy player. Dr. Al-Jaber has also been an outcomes-focused participant at over 11 COPs, including the historic Paris COP21 in 2015. Upon joining Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, ADNOC, as its CEO, Dr. Al-Jaber has spearheaded a $15 billion decarbonization strategy and new low-carbon solutions business. Dr. Al-Haber? They should have it. We should have a pronunciation here on the website. It's written in English. Learn more about Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber's initiatives and priorities on his official website. And now we have H.E. Shama El-Mazri, UAE Youth Climate Champion. And after seeing, you know, browsing the site several times in the past several weeks, months, and seeing these two and doing my Mrs. Tchaikovsky song night last evening, I have come to the resolution that H.E. Shama El-Mazri, the Youth Climate Champion, is really the number one in this program, the first in command, Dr. Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber is the second in command, even though on the public face, Dr. Sultan is the COP president. H.E. Shama Elma, and that's just my opinion, but if you know what I mean, she's first in command. He's second in command. The Youth Climate Champion Rule is designed to amplify the work of youth-led and youth-focused organizations with the COP process. H.E. Shama Elmazoui, Minister of Community Development, will be the first ever youth climate champion with a ministerial role. She will be responsible for engaging with youth globally in the lead up to and during COP28 UAE. This will include working with local and global stakeholders to provide capacity building opportunities for youth, as well as mechanisms to fund youth innovations in the field. H.E. Elmazoui is also the vice chair of the Arab Youth Center, the secretary general of the Education and Human Resources Council, chairperson for Special Olympics UAE, and president of the National Center for Education Quality. Good person to meet and know. H.E. Razan Al Mubarak, UN Climate Change High-Level Champion. As UN Climate Change High-Level Champion, H.E. Razan Al Mubarak will mobilize the private sector and civil society, along with driving efforts to address the climate and nature crisis together. The role of the UN Climate Change High-Level Champion is focused on engaging state and non-state actors, including cities and sub-regional governments, indigenous peoples, civil society, and private sector partners. Now, forgive me, Mr. Mubarak, or Ms., I don't have the pictures in front of me. I have pictures of these leaders on the website, too. But I want to interrupt this Razan El Mubarak, H.E. Razan El Mubarak, bio reading with this statement I should have said before, but when I was talking about the World Trade Organization and the World Health Organization and the World Meteorological Organization, we should think about a World Education Organization. Because I, at 48 years, have yet to see any game face of a World Education Organization within this UN architecture. Al Mubarak will draw upon her, there she go, there we go, she's female. Al Mubarak will draw upon her experience as president of the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN, managing director of the Environment Agency Abu Dhabi, EAD, and managing director of Emirates Nature, WWF, to ensure progress on biodiversity, conservation, and nature-based solutions. H.E. Maryam Al-Mahari, UAE Minister of Climate Change and Environment. H.E. Maryam Al-Mahari will support the COP28 UAE leadership team and continue to lead national progress on climate change, ensuring that the UAE delivers on its climate targets set out by the Paris Agreement and its net zero by 2050 strategic initiative, along with promoting nature-based solutions, including 100 million mangroves by 2030. She will also spearhead the UAE's intention to drive new political visibility and outcomes on food systems transformation at COP28 UAE. The COP28 conference in the United Arab Emirates has a blue zone and a green zone. The blue zone is a UNFCCC-managed site open to accredited party and observer delegates. It hosts the formal negotiations across the 2 weeks of the conference, as well as the World Climate Action Summit, the country pavilions, presidency events, and hundreds of side events including panel discussions, round tables, and cultural events. You can find out more on their website. I believe it's COP28.com. The Green Zone is free of charge and open to everyone. It is a space managed and delivered by the COP28 UAE presidency. The Green Zone offers a platform to non-accredited delegates, including youth groups, civil society, NGOs, the private sector, and indigenous groups to have their voices heard, promoting dialogue and awareness about climate action. Further information on programmed events will be made available once finalized. The thematic program. The COP28 presidency has announced its two-week thematic program geared towards real-world solutions that close the gaps to 2030 and respond to the global stocktake. The presidency has taken an innovative and inclusive approach to the COP28 thematic program. As the first presidency to hold an open consultation on thematic areas and sequencing. The program highlights the sectors and topics raised by stakeholders during consultations, including the themes which need to be part of the COP agenda each year, and new essential topics like health, trade and relief, recovery, and peace. The thematic day's programming incorporates four cross-cutting themes that underpin effective interconnected delivery, technology and innovation, inclusion, frontline communities, and finance. Yeah, it is a big fundraiser. It's just, I really hope it gets to this desk. I'm an optimist. Here is the joint statement. Dr. Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber, President-Designate for COP28 UAE. Dr. Al-Jaber is the first CEO to ever serve, looks like a rerun, to ever serve as COP President and brings with him sound business acumen. There goes my Microsoft partners again. Reprinting script twice. I want you to know, if you're listening and you have a head on your shoulders, that my work has been merchandised and over-merchandised by third parties that do not admit or acknowledge their relationship with and to and for me in over 20 years, probably 30 years. So if you are listening and you have a head on your shoulder, would you please do me the favor and the common courtesy to call me or email me or write me a letter and acknowledge that you heard this program, you listened to this program, regardless of the internet service provider's statements about listeners, followers, and press releases reambiguated on your mainstream press. Do yourself a favor and introduce yourself to me. Let me know you're listening and let me know I have listeners. This is common sense 101. I mean, honest to God, enough with the third party merchandising. It's not innovative, it's not friendly, it does not reduce conflict. You can email me at the following email addresses, michaelanortonsir@gmail.com or heavenlymovie@yahoo.com. These two service providers of email might be the culprits. They might be the ones obliterating my identity, my career, and my economic net worth. While communicating half-truths to the rest of their media consumers. That's not sound UN policy. It's not sound US policy. You can mail me a letter. Don't put any anthrax or any other poison in it. I'm a smoker. I still have to secede from smoking cigarettes, which, by the way, contain carbon monoxide. And carbon monoxide is important in the discussion among climate change leaders and advocates and health leaders and advocates. I spoke to my doctor about this. Carbon monoxide, doctor, do you know how does the discipline and the practice breath a comorbidity between carbon monoxide and lithium, element number 3 on the periodic table of elements? And the doctor I spoke to said, I'm not sure I follow. I don't know. And that's because he's not taught, even at an Ivy League level, a system of magnetism within that curriculum. And magnetism is an ordinary function and property of nature. So with a magnetic translation of the units on the periodic table, which are not presented in British thermal units, but atomic mass units, but with the magnetic translation of that from the whole magnetism system, you can determine and see mathematically that carbon monoxide has a resonance of 36 in billions of unities, and lithium too has a resonance of 36 in billions of unities. And the beautiful thing about this conversion method is that never does a molecule overlap with any of the resonances on the periodic table of elements. They're never identical. So even though they're 36 and 36, carbon monoxide and lithium, we now can step forward and say, well, you know what? Anxiety is not the only comorbidity between lithium and carbon monoxide, but there's a natural resonance related to the two. And when you have a narrow target like that in health, it helps to identify remedies to overcoming whatever condition the patient has. In medicine design, it helps. In usage and prescription, it helps, and that's one small example. But in climate, carbon monoxide reductions is important. Carbon reductions and emissions is important. But if you don't understand that carbon and oxygen and lithium have their own place and function and properties in the daily process and sequence of our tides and atmosphere and environment on planet Earth, then you should be listening to this podcast, and you should be letting me know you're listening. Don't go tell those other third parties that you're listening and bullwink me and the rest of planet Earth. You can phone or text me. I'm sorry my voicemail doesn't work. I don't have Hollywood's voicemail system class yet. But you can text me or call me and I'll pick up if it rings at 424-395-6236 and let me know you've heard of my work and it interests you because you work in the field as well. And you have to dial +1 area code because I'm in the United States of America. That's +1-424-395-6236 Or you can call in when I'm doing this live podcast on Blog Talk Radio. In theory, I haven't got one call yet. It's been about 150 podcasts this year. You call in at +1-563-999-3703. So I have more paper and not enough money paper. We've heard about Dr. Al-Jabir and H.C. Razan Al-Mubarak, H.C. Maryam Al-Masiri, the Blue Zone, the Green Zone, the thematic program. Ridiculous. I should have already met these people. I've met Dina Yakuba down at the Bangor City Council from that part of the world, that region. Maybe not the UAE, but I've met her. Since 1993, the World Meteorological Organization, the WMO, through the Commission for Climatology and in cooperation with its members, has issued annual statements on the status of the global climate to provide credible scientific information on climate and its variability. All right. So, we're a half hour into this program. Let's talk about the average temperature on planet Earth. Your various media feeds are as follows. From space.com by Vicky Stein and Tim Sharp, with contributions from Daisy Dobrzejewicz. Last updated September 20th, 2023. The average surface temperature on Earth is approximately 59 degrees Fahrenheit, 15 degrees Celsius, according to NASA. And there's a hyperlink, according to NASA. So why don't Vicky Stein, Tim Sharp, and Daisy Dobrzejewicz of space.com, instead of including a hyperlink called According to NASA, elaborate on their journalistic integrity and research skills in average temperature on Earth? Why don't they say it like this? The average surface temperature on Earth is approximately blah, 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 and we're not certain that is without bias because of an organization like NASA. These are journalists. These are people working in New York City, the financial capital of the world. And yes, that is bias because I'm an American, I'm in the U.S., and it is considered by many a financial capital of the world and the United States. So what are these journalists living and working in New York City for? And they're just dumping it onto a highly secure, highly secretive aerospace program of our government. Right after that, there's another hyperlink, and this is a daily occurrence. I know they do this all year round. They put out these articles. NASA recently announced there's another hyperlink. We can't speak for ourselves. We can only regurgitate what NASA says. NASA recently announced, and I love NASA. I think they have some incredible data points and data collections and archives and innovation and enlightenment for this planet. But they're not Superman. They're not 1,000 batting at the Major League Baseball. They're not 17-0, 20-0 at the NFL to the Super Bowl. They also, from time to time, have to make corrections. They have errors. They make mistakes. You all know that. NASA recently announced, according to Vicki Stein, Tim Sharp, and Daisy Dobrojevic of space.com, that 2023 was Earth's hottest summer on record since at least 1880. Now, I ask you this. In 1880, how many people were measuring the temperature of planet Earth, and what were their resources? What were their technological instruments without, obviously, an internet or a television or radio system or network, without a telephone network, maybe a telegraph, without airplanes, without satellites? What was their method in 1880 for measuring the temperature of a planet with approximately 7,900 mile diameter? With how many people then? Were there a million? Based on NASA's temperature data, NASA recently announced that 2023 was Earth's hottest summer on record since at least 1880. Okay, that's fine. It's fine. They're taking a bunch of averages and mathematicians that have out-of-date methods, and they're averaging them out to give us a non-scientific collective archival data point for the world's global temperature. In the 21st century, based on NOAA's temperature data, National Oceanic Atmosphere Association, a member of the same U.S. government as NASA, that does not include everyone in the U.S. That does not include all U.S. civilians. I want my national and international and local listeners to know that and be aware of that. It does not include everyone. Based on NOAA's temperature data, 2020 was the second warmest year ever recorded, just behind 2016. It has been hot lately. Wow, it has been hot, but it was also hot many decades ago, according to history books. In the 21st century, the average yearly temperature on Earth has been more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit, more than 1 degree Celsius higher than recorded pre-industrial temperature. The problem I have with this is it's not really climate science. They're not looking at it. They're not giving evidence to provide a perspective from nature, but from historians. Here it is from phys.org, from phys.org, August 19th, 2015. What is the Earth's average temperature? It's the title of the article. That's the title of my Google search. This is what came up in 2023 of all my Google non-known people who work for Google. I don't have employment. I don't get an income beyond $12,000 a year in the United States of America. This is by Matt Williams, Universe Today. I should be making $250,000 every year. I was talking to my friend, one of the mailmen, the postal workers, about it yesterday. And he said, oh, you just want a lump sum settlement like one of those people get those lump sum settlements. I said, yeah, I do want that. I walked away. But the truth is, no, I don't want just a lump sum. I want to be making $250,000 a year, every year, because that's my job. I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not an MD, I'm not a bankruptcy lawyer, but I am a very good mathematician, and I have a great load of experience with your communications and journalism and press industry. And they don't have to be making $250,000 a year every year either, but there are producers that are making a hell of a lot more than that every year in the same industry. This is by Matt Williams. What is the Earth's average temperature? August 19th, 2015 from phys.org. Variations. The average temperature on the surface of Earth depends on a number of factors. By the way, I asked the guy at the local newspaper office front desk yesterday, what's the Earth's average temperature? He said he didn't know. He looked scared. I said, well, can you look it up for me? And he did. And it was a different number than what was printed out and what I'm reading you today. And it was also incorrect. The average temperature on the surface of Earth depends on a number of factors. So does Google have to pay a tax or a fine? Don't they have to pay a fine for offering such a disparate, wide spectrum of total propaganda on their search engine from person to person, from locality to locality? I would think so. The number of factors regarding the surface of the Earth's average temperature are the time of day, the time of year, and where the temperature's measurements are being taken. Mother Earth has a temperature in Fahrenheit, which can be converted to Celsius and expressed on the 10th and 100th scale, order of magnitude, exponentially. That's number, number, dot, number, number, degrees Fahrenheit. That's Mother Nature's gift to human civilization, just like 98.6 Fahrenheit and 37 Celsius is for our internal ecosystem. And guess what? It's okay if we diverge from that too, isn't it? Because then we know we're ill. And the doctor knows, and the nurses know, and the off-the-shelf medicine makers and sellers know how to help us get better again. The same should apply to the climate industry. We've got 2 weeks this year, right? COP28. Let's set the standard straight for the global temperature average of planet Earth. Given that the Earth experiences a sidereal rotation of approximately 24 hours, which means one side is never always facing towards the sun, I'm going to start singing. This is Matt Williams. What is the Earth's average temperature? From phys.org. That's a reference to physics. Is that a reference? It's not a reference to physicians. By the way, my physician, when I asked him the average temperature, he gave me one, and I said to him, you know what, your guess, because there was a guess, because he said, I don't know, I don't know. I said, well, if you had to guess, what would you guess? And he gave me a guess. I said, well, your guess was closer to the average global temperature than what Google's, or what's published online, I said, not Google. I said, what's published online? Because online can include television and radio, too, and newspaper. And he laughed. It was great. Because he should know. He should be closer to it if we're talking about health and climate. Sidereal rotation, approximately 24 hours. Which means one side is never always facing towards the sun, the planet. Temperatures rise in the day and drop in the evening. sometimes substantially. And given that Earth has an inclined axis, approximately 23 degrees towards the sun's equator, the northern and southern hemispheres of Earth are either tilted towards or away from the sun during the summer and winter season, respectively. And given that equatorial regions of the Earth are closer to the sun, and certain parts of the world experience more sunlight and less cloud cover, temperatures range widely across the planet. However, not every region on the planet experiences four seasons. At the equator, the temperature is on average higher and the region does not experience cold and hot seasons in the same way the northern and southern hemispheres do. This is because the amount of sunlight that reaches the equator changes very little. Although the temperatures do vary somewhat during the rainy season, and then Mr. Williams has a measurement section. He's going to outlay for us how this is measured. According to PHYS.org, what is PHYS.org's daily, monthly, quarterly budget? What is it each year? What is the return on investment? It's a nonprofit, of course. .org. What's their return on investment? How do they stay open? What's their average salary per employee? How many employees do they have? The average surface temperature on Earth is approximately 7.2 degrees Celsius. Though, as already noted, this varies. For instance, what are they doing? Sticking thermometers into the ground? For instance, the hottest temperature ever recorded on Earth was 70.7 degrees Celsius, 159 degrees Fahrenheit, which was taken in the Lutz Desert of Iran. These measurements were part of a global temperature survey conducted by scientists at NASA's Earth Observatory during the summers of 2003 to 2009. So let us now take more time and money and give it to NASA's lawyers and NASA's courts and Iran's lawyers and Iran's courts, because somebody in both regions are going to get upset and irate about their inclusion with these extreme reports. For 5 of the 7 years surveyed, 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2009, the Lut Desert was the hottest spot on Earth. Why do we have a media and a central intelligence agency? What is the point of having both? However, it was not the hottest spot for every single year in the survey. In 2003, the satellites recorded a temperature of 69.3 degrees Celsius, 156.7 Fahrenheit. This whole article is a filibuster. All it's doing, all this writer is doing, whoever Matt Williams of phys.org is filibustering. He's not explaining any science, educating his readers about how this ridiculous data set of temperatures, this list, this output could have been a random username and password generator. It has that much integrity. In relation to the search, what is the average temperature of planet Earth? What is the daily average temperature of planet Earth? If we have the standard agreement of that with proof, then we can, from region to region and locality to locality, see and explain why it varies so much from that average. Spotting out geopolitical extremism. In 2003, the shrublands of Queensland, Australia. In 2008, the Turpan Basin in Western China. Meanwhile, the coldest temperature ever recorded on Earth was measured at the Soviet Vostok station on the Antarctic plateau. What, pray tell, is significant about St. Petersburg and the 59th latitude, 59th parallel on planet Earth in terms of climate, daily tidal sequence, and your health? What is significant about it? Call now at +1-563-999-3703. There is something beautifully, phenomenally, naturally significant, which leads me to believe that is the reason why, and Moscow is not far from that latitude either, but that's the reason why humans got to space in a satellite first for human spaceflight, just like the Wright brothers did for air and air flight here in the States, from Russia. There's a natural data point about that position on our planet. And it's the same from the direction of the South Pole. But that latitude point is less populated by humans than the northern latitude, just as it is here in Bangor, Maine, and wrapped around to the Mongolian-China border. It's the same latitude parallel. Not the same as Moscow's in St. Petersburg's, they're farther north. It's much colder up there. It's hot and sunny. It's like Miami here in Bangor, Maine, compared to there. Let me read more. He's Matt's listing out extreme temperatures. Extreme highs, extreme lows, ground measurements. All of these measurements were based on temperature readings that were performed in accordance with the World Meteorological Organization standard. So is PHYS.org an implementation of the World Meteorological Organization? I don't know. By these regulations, air temperature, now he's moving from measurements to regulations, or standard at the WMO. By these regulations, air temperature is measured out of direct sunlight. Because the materials in and around the thermometer can absorb radiation and affect the sensing of heat. And thermometers are to be situated 1.2 to 2 meters off the ground. And that's the end of the excerpt that's taken from Mr. Williams, phys.org article. Is there a World Mathematical Organization? is within the World Meteorological Organization standard, is there a mathematical standard? Or are we just selling thermometers? Our publishing is operated by a completely in-house team. This is from Matt's article at phys.org, a completely in-house team. So what does that mean? Does it mean they're part of World Meteorological Organization or what? Or NASA's Earth Observatory or Iran's Lutz Desert or Australia's Flaming Mountain? No, I'm sorry, that's Western China. Australia's Queensland Shrublands? Stephanie Baum is scientific editor. We're going to learn now about Mrs. Tchaikovsky's show last night. That was a cappella singing by yours truly. You can find it on my blogtalkradio.com/strutforth podcast URL. That was a all early Randy Newman lyrics reimagined by yours truly in today's global climate for Mrs. Tchaikovsky. That's a moniker for somebody I never met. Stephanie holds a master's degree in TESOL from the New School in New York and joined Business Forgers in 2021. I'm using Business Forgers as a moniker for something else as well, because I believe it deserves a media presence. She is passionate about cooking, language learning, linguistics, and editing. Stephanie loves to read and edit articles detailing discoveries across the sci-tech realm, especially those involving biology and space exploration. In addition to her work in Business Forgers, she has written numerous patient education articles on topics within medicine and dentistry. Robert Egan is an associate editor. Robert had to live in 11 cities and 3 countries before finding a place that felt like home. He's a picky guy, and that's probably why he enjoys being an editor. In addition to a bachelor's degree in mathematical biology and a master's degree in creative writing, Robert possesses a small street dog with a large overbite who likes to hunt crabs on the beach. Owen Ferguson, scientific editor. Owen began editing technical work for lay audiences in 1998, working for the Toronto Star newspaper before becoming a full-time freelancer. He attended Ryerson Polytechnic University's journalism program before graduating with a Bachelor's of Independent Studies in Forensic Database Architecture from the University of Waterloo. Owen has been copy editing for Business Forgers since 2020. Lisa Locke is a scientific editor. Lisa is a content and copy editor with backgrounds in the arts and medicine. She has a BA in art history and an MA in material culture. During her diverse career, she has been a publications editor in a decorative arts museum, an emergency paramedic, and an organ transplant coordinator. She has an eye for fine detail, a passion for grammar, and dedication to lifelong learning. She has been editing for Business Forgers since 2021. Christopher Packham, content editor. Chris has written and edited for newspapers and alt news weeklies since 2003, including the Kansas City Star, The Pitch, and The Village Voice. He has been copy editing and occasionally writing for Business Forges since 2013. He lives in Brooklyn, New York, with his spouse and two dogs. Alexander Paul is deputy editor. Alex holds a PhD in nanoengineering from Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. He is an author and co-author of numerous scientific publications. Alex served as a reviewer for various peer-reviewed scientific journals before launching his career in scientific journalism. Business Forgers values Alex's thoughtful and careful scientific insight in developing policy and creating standards for content. We have at ptable.com, it's a very informative website about the periodic table of elements, and it's interactive. A great implementation of World Wide Web standards for those scientific minds and mathematical minds. And we do not have a table MD, capital M, capital D. We don't have a tablemd.com yet, and we should. We have a webmd.com, and I say that because WebMD and Business Forgers are in New York City, the home of the World United Nations headquarters. Sadie Harley, scientific editor. Sadie began her editing career in 1999 in Pharma News. After 5 years, Sadie took a career break to raise two sons. On returning to the work arena, she conducted online research with the oil and gas industry, followed by editing in the recycling and energy from waste industries. In recent years, Sadie has returned to her interest in medical research, working on clinical trial documents. Sadie was very happy to join the Business Forgers team in 2023. She holds a Bachelor of Science in Life Sciences and Ecology. Is a BSc, a Bachelor in Science, yes. So used to looking at Bachelor of Arts. Living in the UK, she's had homes in Wales, Scotland, just 6 miles from the banks of Loch Ness, and England, settling in Devon. John Benson, honorary editor. John joined Business Forgers in 2006, and his guidance was invaluable in creating reliable and trustworthy science and technology stories for Business Forgers. Contributing authors. I don't know, it looks like a medical AWOL team has taken over a phys.org site about climate science, a hostile takeover. Ingrid Fadeli. Ingrid is a freelance journalist and science enthusiast with a BSc in psychology and an MA in international journalism, both from City, University of London. She regularly writes articles for numerous online publications, media websites, and research outreach companies. Her primary interests include artificial intelligence, robotics, psychology, neuroscience, environmental science, and astrophysics. Ingrid started writing for Business Forgers in 2018 and now covers a wide range of research-based topics. What is the difference between research-based and evidence-based, Mr. Berners-Lee? And I ask you this because you have a hyphenate in your surname. And research-based and evidence-based are two often used hyphen double words in the English Compendium of Communications this century. What's the difference between research-based and evidence-based? You can't have evidence without research. where is the base? Where's the base of this English communications practice? Bob Yerka has always been fascinated by science and has spent large portions of his life with his nose buried in textbooks or magazines. He has a Bachelor of Science degree in computer science and a Master of Science in Information Systems Management. He's worked in a variety of positions in the telecommunications field, ranging from help desk jockey to systems analyst to MIS manager. Recently, after nearly 20 years in the business, he's decided to move to what he really loves doing, and that is writing. In addition to writing for Business Forgers, Bob has also sold several short stories and has written 3 novels. And that's a nice irony there, because short stories is hyphenated. And we should make, as a collective nation and a global collective civilization, we should make New York City's MetLife Stadium, where the New York Giants play, LCS Stadium. We should make it Lunar Computation Systems Stadium, because without Lunar Computation Systems, we don't have a Mother Natural Earth average temperature every day, every season, every year on this world we live in this lifetime. So what is that global temperature, Einsteins? Call in and tell me, +1-563-999-3703. I'm just perusing our media. Hannah Bird. Hannah Bird is a doctoral researcher in oceanography, climatology, and paleontology at the University of Birmingham, UK. She specializes in terrestrial and marine flora and fauna responses to past global warming events and their implications for future climate change, including her research on the oldest known amphibian footprints in the UK, which was widely covered in national and global media. Hannah is a freelance editor and content creator with over 10 years of experience translating complex scientific principles into mainstream print and digital media for earth science journals, including The Geological Curator and Paleontologica Electronica. The Paleontological Association's newsletter and the Geological Society of London's Geoscientist magazine. That's Hannah Bird. Why do I think it's Saoirse Ronan? Tomasz Nowakowski. Tomasz is a longtime space enthusiast and amateur astronomer. And it sounds like Steven Spielberg. He founded and managed AstroWatch for nearly a decade, one of the premier astronomy and science-related blogs. Tomasz has been freelancing since 2011, writing for many media outlets, including Spaceflight Insider, Science 2.0, Space Coast Daily, From Quarks to Quasars, AstroWatch. He managed that for nearly a decade, or she, Tomasz. I don't know, Tomasz. T-O-M-A-S-Z. That's the second benchmark goal for COP28. We'll be talking about that on the podcast next week. The lunar hand, the lunar hour hand on your watches and clock faces. If you are able to determine the lunar hour of the day and you're a physician in the doctor's office, you're able to determine what tide it is, what one of the 4 tides it is of that day. And with your knowledge of your region and locality on planet Earth, you can easily integrate that with your treatment plan, your remedy plan for your patients. And it's important because the daily tides are better than the best military uniform officers, the ones who put uniform code into practice, the sequence of the daily tides, the E20. I call it the E20 now, thanks to the G20, because the E20, the E stands for the elements. The 21 through 20 you count every day from the perspective of the tides on planet Earth. And for each of those spaces of 20, if the tidal intervals are a little over 6 hours long, then the average, and let's be careful with that, the average for the sequence of each is about 72 minutes, right? But let's be careful about that because we're looking at it from a tidal, a lunar causality. It's not the UTC time causality. And that's why we need the lunar hand on our clocks, because carbon is what we're trying to focus on in this climate industry. Carbon reductions so that the environment is as natural and adaptive as possible for we, the civilization, planet we live on. I've met people who want to live off the land, and that's all they want to do. They think NASA is like proverbially, and I'm using my own creative fat here, like a satanic cult. But that's their sentiment about NASA. They think it's bad for the planet Earth. And then there's people from the NASA community who think the same thing about those people. You've got to set some standards. So hopefully this two-week conference will result in understanding three things. This is my perspective. One, the global temperature of planet Earth that Mother Nature provides us every day. Two, there's a lunar hand that belongs on our clocks and watches, so we know what the moon and the things, the moon and the Earth and their gravitational pull between one another, produce for us at the level of the elements and the atmosphere and the environment every day. And the third is the LC200. I'll be talking about that 2 weeks from now. Can we have 200 people, each from one member nation state of these G20 ordinances, these World Meteorological Organization standards? Can we have these 200? Can we set a goal for 200 countries and nation states? Because, for example, the European Union has a number of nation states. Can we have signatures on the quantity in order of 200 in sum, saying we're pledging to make ourselves aware of a magnetism system and unit of measure for our schools and our businesses? That would be awesome for me, because it's very difficult for me to please Mrs. Tchaikovsky when she's not in my life. If I am to be Mr. Tchaikovsky of the 21st century, because we share the same birthday. Now I'm a big fan of music. And Mr. Tchaikovsky, but not as big a fan as I am of Mrs. Tchaikovsky. Delcia Richt is an award-winning science writer and author. Her stories have been published in a variety of newspapers and magazines, including Newsday, where she was a staff writer. Discover Magazine, the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, and numerous other publications. How do I behave seriously? How do I act really serious? Because if we can give our doctors a 1 8.5 by 11 cheat sheet piece of paper that shows, for example, the elementary polar radiuses of the hour in which they are practicing, that they can use as a reference to the periodic table. Remember, carbon monoxide is carbon and oxygen. All of your medicines, almost all of them, have carbon and oxygen along with their hydrogen and nitrogen bonding. If the doctors and nurses can have a cheat sheet that gives them situational awareness at the very hour of their practice, we may end up living in a world together that has reduced all disease and disorder to nothing other than the common cold from season to season. I think it's possible, and I don't have an MD, and my MD, one at least, thinks it's possible. He's told it to me directly. He believes that too. I think that's awesome. So Delphia Ricks has published in many publications. She additionally has written 4 books. The most recent, 100 Questions and Answers About Coronaviruses. Ricks is a graduate of the University of California, Los Angeles, where she received a Bachelor of Arts in English with a minor in biology. She has a Master's of Arts in English from Columbia University in New York, and an MS, Master's in Science in Biology, from the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. Ricks has completed additional postgraduate work in the Tropical Infectious Diseases Program at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Delphia Ricks, why am I looking at the Weather Channel and seeing a subtropical jet stream by name? Isn't there a more scientifically general appreciation of that designation of the weather system? You should know, since you have published and written in so many highly affluent publications. Samarisi Jiwandara. Samarisi Jiwandara, PhD, is a researcher and science writer with a doctorate in medicine and bioengineering from the University of Sydney, Australia. She has multidisciplinary postdoctoral research experience as a research scientist in biochemistry, plasma physics, genetics, bone tissue engineering, paleontology, cell dynamics, and organ-on-a-chip technology broadly within the U.S. and internationally. Samarisi enjoys traveling, reading, writing, the theater and fine arts. The Christmas Carol is playing at the Penobscot Community Theater this day and through December. Right across the street from Taste of India. Delicious cuisine, the finest Indian extraordinary cooking ship. From naan breads of garlic, plain and butter kind, all kinds of vegetarian and meat, spicy mixed veggie concoction. Peter Grad was a reporter, columnist, and editor at newspapers in his hometown of the Bronx, Meriden, Connecticut, and then for 32 years in New Jersey at The Record. He was the op-ed page editor at The Record for 18 years and also contributed a weekly computer column beginning in the 90s under the titles The Computer Tutor and The PC Guide. He designed a prototype for a video and audio-enhanced online multimedia newspaper for The Record years before that became the norm for the nation's leading papers. He designed a prototype for a video and audio-enhanced online multimedia newspaper for The Record years before that became the norm for the nation's leading papers. Peter and his wife, Rose, recently moved to Cary, North Carolina. He misses Zabar's, Levain Cookies, Central Park, Prince Street Pizza, and Manhattan's cool rock and blues venues. He doesn't miss the traffic or the snow. Justin Jackson. Justin has been covering science news as a host of This Week in Science, TWIS podcast, since 2004. The weekly program brings a slightly irreverent yet fervently pro-science perspective to recent research across all scientific subjects. While he has previously worked in biotech research labs running fermentation experiments and in genomics labs running next-generation sequencers, Justin's first love of science is in communicating the stories to a wider audience. Justin joins the Business Forgers team after many years of being an avid reader and fan of their publications. Well, maybe he wants to magnetosphere with me. Tejasri Gururaj. Tejasri is a freelance science writer, journalist with an MS in physics. She explores diverse scientific disciplines and enjoys research-driven writing. When not at her keyboard, you can find her in front of the TV with her feline companions, eating delicious food or napping. Lisa Zygott. Lisa graduated from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign with a Bachelor of Arts degree in rhetoric in 2004. She subsequently completed a science writing internship at Fermilab, hey, I've been there, followed by a communications internship at Caterpillar. Since then, she has been writing in a freelance capacity for a variety of science, technology, and other publications. Lisa began writing for Business Forgers in 2005, providing engaging and interesting editorials about scientific developments. Lisa's stimulating and accurate science and technology articles have made her very popular among Business Forgers readers. Stuart Mason Dambrot. As a consilientist, Mr. Dambrot analyzes deep structure, interconnections between multiple areas of knowledge and creativity, focus on the synthesis of a precise conceptual language that communicates the common neocortical foundations of human intellectual expression. As a futurist, Mr. Dambrot identifies, monitors, and extrapolates convergent and emergent trends in a wide range of areas, including computing, communications, energy, neuroscience, nanotechnology, biotechnology, synthetic biology, molecular electronics, artificial intelligence, robotics, quantum computing and communications and quantum neurobiology. And I watched part of Stripes yesterday with Bill Murray. And that lady, the blonde, that was incredible. It was a very funny movie. It's like 3 hours long, too, I think. I only saw a little bit of it yesterday, but the lady in it was like a spitting image from the time in Maryland. Mr. Dambrot speaks and writes about a wide range of topics, many of which are covered in his blog, Critical Thought. He has written for Business Forgers, MedicalExpress.com, Nature, Science, Nature Biotechnology, New Scientist, Scientific American, IEEE Spectrum, Electronics, Columbia University 21st C, Economist, Financial Times, International Herald Tribune, Japan Times, EE Times, Photonics Spectra, Chemical Week. Mr. Dambrot holds a degree in physiological psychology. It may have been Heather Locklear. I don't know. I have to look it up. The actress, lead actress in Stripes. Bill Murray, out of work, New York City, decides to join the Army. John Hewitt. John's background in physics and neuroscience. He worked in industry for many years in a variety of electrical and mechanical engineering roles. He also ran CRE Precision, a machine shop specializing in the design of biomedical instruments, for 10 years. He sold the business in 2012 to pursue the goal of full-time science reading and has been able to find gainful employment writing in the fields of neuroscience, cell biology, and general technology. Then we have Laura Migardishian, John Messina, Lynn Edwards, Miranda Marquis, and Ted Goodman's short bios also, but for purposes of condensation, conservation, and time, I'm going to read from World of Change Global Temperatures, parentheses NASA.gov, Earth Observatory, that's Earth Observatory, excuse me. It's from earthobservatory.nasa.gov. And a personal note to myself, where is Earth Observatory with NASA? Where is it? Here it is from their website about global temperatures. Air temperatures on Earth have been rising since the Industrial Revolution, while natural variability plays some part. The preponderance of evidence indicates that human activities, particularly emissions of heat-trapping greenhouse gases, are mostly responsible for making our planet warmer. According to an ongoing temperature analysis led by scientists at NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, the average global temperature on Earth has increased by at least 1.1 degrees Celsius, 1.9 degrees Fahrenheit, since 1880. The majority of the warming has occurred since 1975 at a rate of roughly 0.15 to 0.20 degrees Celsius per decade. The maps above show temperature anomalies in five-year increments since 1880. Well, Pyotr Tchaikovsky would have been 40 years old. Is that right? I don't know. He would have been in his 40s, I think. Or 30s, maybe. These are not absolute temperatures, but changes from the norm for each area. So what is the absolute global temperature of planet Earth every day? It's set for us, for Moses. It's set for Jesus. It was set for Muhammad and Buddha, the compassionate one. It was set for you and I and our ancestors, and it's set for our descendants by Mother Earth the sun and the moon and the solar system? What is the absolute daily temperature average of planet Earth? If we have that standard set, then we could diverge from region and region, locality to locality, and optimize our practices, whatever our practices are. These are not absolute temperatures, but changes from the norm for each area. The data reflect how much warmer or cooler each region was compared to a base period of 1951 to 1980. So if you were born in the year 1975, you only have 24 years of history prior to that. All else, you must rely on NASA for employment. The global mean surface air temperature for that period was 57 degrees Fahrenheit or 14 degrees Celsius, with an uncertainty of several tenths of a degree. The image below shows global temperature anomalies in 2022, which tied for the fifth warmest year on record. The past 9 years have been the warmest years since modern record keeping began in 1880. Oh boy. Well, Seth Borenstein from APnews.com, July 7, 2023, published 12:52 a.m. Eastern Standard Time online, says Earth's average temperature set a new unofficial record high on Thursday. It's also a record with some legitimate scientific questions and caveats, so much so that the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has distanced itself from it. It's grabbed global attention even as the number, 63 degrees Fahrenheit, 17.23 degrees Celsius, doesn't look that hot because it averages temperatures from around the globe. Still, scientists say the daily drumbeat of records, official or not, is a symptom of a larger problem where the precise digits aren't as important as what's causing them. I disagree with Seth Borenstein because I think by setting that standard so low, the automated industries, intelligence, the artificial intelligence, the automated industrialization of our planet reacts from business to business and corporation to individual and individual too much. There's too much overreaction. You set it that low, there's machines that go into work trying to respond to that. And that outputs heat. I know that because I've studied about oxidative phosphorylation. I've studied about language and poetry. And oxidative phosphorylation is the transfer between light and heat. And I've studied light because I have a Bachelor of Arts in Cinema. You set it that low, the world's going to get hotter. If you set it at Mother Nature's rate, kumbaya, we can celebrate. And we can get on with whatever it is our discipline is in our work-life balanced world. We can have different recipes for food. But we don't have to send the whole food program into overdrive so that I get to eat an orange from Israel on one day and an orange from Guatemala on the next day, an orange from Florida and California on the next day, all in the same week, and there's people dropping dead on the streets from God knows they should not be. The Washington Post says, we're tracking dangerous heat waves across the U.S. daily. Instrument-based global temperature records go back to the mid-19th century, but for temperatures before that, scientists are dependent on proxy data. captured through evidence left in tree rings and ice cores. The great thing, the icing on the cake for the magnetism system of measure, which we have not had. If you do not believe me, go into your schools, go into your universities and ask them, is there a department of magnetism? Is there a department set aside from all the other disciplines that teaches and integrates those disciplines' understandings and awareness in relation to magnetism? My doctors say, no, they don't have those there. They don't have those there. That's because they've been working with equations. They haven't been working with a system for magnetism. And we're living in an electronic age, and magnetism has a relation with electronics. So why am I reading bio after bio for business forgers this morning? Call me and let me know. You can email me. It's all there on this podcast, all my contact information. Even if you're from Business Forgers, you can call me up and say, hi, email me, write me a letter, send me a check, send me a PayPal amount, donate to me. The Sultan has money. He's wealthy. He's part of the G20 Blue Ring, Green Ring program. They're way up there riding Jason and the Argonauts and Santa Claus's sleigh through fairy tale lands and Hollywood. Upper echelon Hollywood, very high-end Hollywood. We're talking Spielberg, James Cameron, and now Greta Gerwig. Don't call them. Call me. Send your money to michaelanortonsir@gmail.com via PayPal. We've had PayPal for years, probably as long as Google. So temperature is the icing on the cake. Why is it 32 degrees Fahrenheit? Elementary speaking, why does it freeze? Why does water freeze at that point? Why does it become snow at that point? Why do we now have a global temperature average for every day on Earth? And why is magnetism not being taught in our schools today, in our businesses? Why is Cleopatra not on the musical stage, Broadway? The average is very easy to establish. If we look at our daily tidal systems index, and we know from our schedules, thanks to all those people I just read, all their disciplines, all those people working in those disciplines, we know there are four tides every day. We know they are high and low and high and low, and we know what the times are between those tides. We know how to make a schedule for those tides. Those people do. But if we apply the magnetism system as a lens to that natural process, then we are able to determine and calculate the temperature and back it up with evidence that Mother Earth provides us to allow the trees to breathe and grow and the plants and vegetables and fruits and animals, and allow the minerals to plasticize and transform themselves or petrify themselves, erode and corrode. Randy Newman has informed me through his music that the Rust Belt is not something out of the Midwest. The Rust Belt is worldwide. It's a worldwide phenomenon. Will we get to Mars someday? I have 14 seconds left on this podcast. No, 14 minutes. All right. Plenty of time for a good breakfast. we can determine the average temperature of planet Earth by looking at the tidal sequence. We can annotate the field lines of planet Earth that tidal sequence, the daily tides, consist of. They are intangibles. We cannot take a piece of thread, a tether, even if we're NASA and all the other space program leaders, you can't take a 3,950-mile-long thread and put it on a scaffold and say, here's our instrumentation point for 120 years of recorded data. Because the field lines are loops, and they don't work at surface alone. They work at surface all the way up 62 miles into our atmosphere and 62 miles underneath the surface of the Earth. Right now, every day, and in quantity and sum, that's discrete. It doesn't mean the Earth has field lines no more than that, but it means the ones that contribute to our tides and our climate have a discrete quantity. And when they do, scientists, researchers know and are aware that the time and space, like longitude and latitude, can therefore be determined, each of those field loops. Physicians should know that too, nurses as well, and you, students. Because that's the pathway to accomplishment by not only the G20, but by you and me as well. Everyone in the community, whether they're working at the health center, the disease cure center, or the journalistic integrity center, or the entertainment center. I should have posted, I think I did, I posted on this podcast a dashboard from a boombox from the 80s that a local shopkeeper had on display here in Bangor, Maine. And it has the frequencies of the frequency modulation and the amplitude modulation, the FM and AM radio dial on it. And then it has shortwave, two shortwave functions. And curiously enough, it left out that higher above hydrogen resonance signal that is used apparently by FCC and other communications components for emergency responders. That's tangent, but it's not, because it's part of the same system and magnetism. It doesn't have to be isolated just to radio biology and chemistry. That's why we have mathematics. That's why we have the Mendelevian table. That's why I have emailed Russia this week. Wonderful, beautiful looking university and primary school caretaker there. That's it. Mendeleev Institute, I think it's called. I have to brush up on my Russian. It's been 200 years since I lived as Pyotr Tchaikovsky. I do miss you, Mrs. Tchaikovsky. All right, so if I announce this temperature global average that I would like to argue, I feel like I would be cheating myself, because I see a lot of talking heads in our media today getting paid a lot more than I do, And I read you some bios, some of them today, on this program. So I thank you for listening, and I thank you for reaching back to me if you ever do, because I know you do have a head on your shoulders. Thank you. This is Mike Lanty Norton, and we'll see you next week to talk about the lunar hour hand on our clocks and watches as part of this COP28 Support Auxiliary three-part series, COP28. The average global temperature of Earth is off, but it is not doomsday. It is not a doomsday clock. It is common sense when you apply the magnetism system as a whole system of measure and unity with your other standard international systems of measure and learning and practice. Thank you very much.